Okay, next up, item seven, we have a review of private credit by our consultants from Stepstone. Brian?
Yes, today we do have representatives of Stepstone here to discuss Cicero's private credit portfolio and allocation. As a reminder, private credit is a component of Cicero's growth portfolio. We expect private credit to generate attractive risk-adjusted returns, generate current income, provide reduced volatility or help reduce volatility in the overall growth portfolio, and also provide diversification benefits. The private credit mandate, it's structured as a fund of one, and Stepstone implements the mandate on behalf of Cicero. Staff and Stepstone, we work very collaboratively throughout the year with regularly scheduled bi-weekly update calls where we really discuss investment opportunities and really exchange observations on the general credit market environment. This really helps ensure that we have a really transparent and ongoing dialogue on the portfolio and really future allocation changes or potential improvements to the portfolio in general. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Stepstone, and they're going to give a very detailed update on our portfolio.
Good morning. I would first of all like to thank the board trustee and the investment team for the trust and the excellent cooperation over not just the last year, but the previous years as well. We highly appreciate. My name is Marcel Schindler. I'm heading the private debt team at Stepstone globally. Today with me, my partner, Ariel Goldblatt. She's running our New York team. We have prepared an update, and maybe I will not run through all in detail certain parts we have covered in previous years, so I will touch very, very briefly, but very open to take any questions on the way. I start with a short group update. Quickly, what is private debt? That's the part we covered in previous years, but maybe there is one or the other questions I'm happy to cover. But then I would like to spend a little bit time on the market environment and how we look at it and how that might impact future allocation and what we expect in terms of returns. And then we would like to dive a bit deeper into the review of the program and obviously the current portfolio performance. Allow me to start very quickly with the group update, and I think the very good and important news is on a corporate level, there were no changes within Stepstone that are major to be reported. The business developed well. We are focused on private markets only. That's private equity, private debt, infrastructure, and real estate. We're responsible for about $700 billion. We're publicly listed, i.e. the next quarterly results will be released very soon and obviously easy for you to have a look into. We allocate per year about $70 billion. I think that's a very important number that provides us good access to all the relevant GPs and into all transactions that might be attractive for the pension fund. We do this service with over 1,000 professionals globally in more than 25 offices. Within Stepstone, Ariel and I represent the private debt team. Here, what you're going to see as well, that business grew nicely. It is an asset class that really has been very attractive for investors over the last years to the reasons that were just mentioned before. I believe when you look at our team and here as well, the good thing to report, no changes in senior management. That means on managing director level and partner level, the team grew. We're 75 investment professionals, but on top, we have more than 100 dedicated resources just for the private debt business. With this, we're by far the largest advisor in the private debt space, but as well, probably because the senior team is together for more than 25 years as of today, one of the most experienced teams in the market. Now, I will jump over the part what is private debt, but what I would love to mention here is that the core part of the program that we manage for you is focused on corporate debt, and within corporate debt on the performing side and the first lien senior secured credits, actually, which is very important. That's the asset class that in our mind has one of the best risk-adjusted returns available, produces stable cash flow, reduces volatility, and I think that is very, very attractive, as I will show in a second as well in the current market environment. The middle market we discussed a bit the last time, you know, just to mention again, so the companies getting these credits, it's about 200,000 companies in the US, it's one third of the private GDP in the US. It's the largest job creator in the US, so it's a very substantial and important market to the US economy to actually grow businesses, employment, and wealth ultimately across the US. Why do we believe private debt is actually very attractive? And I jump forward to a slide that we probably showed previously, but it shows a bit the longer term return of private debt and direct lending especially compared to other asset classes. These are the returns since 2005 till the end of 2024. And what the left chart actually shows is, first of all, with direct lending, you achieve equity-like returns, but with significant lower volatility compared to the equity, public equity side. And if you then look at the right-hand side, looking at the major market corrections, the so-called drawdowns in public markets, what you see there as well is that direct lending drawdowns were much more benign, very minimal actually in 2022. You didn't even have a correction, which I think really speaks for the asset class in a portfolio context especially. Now, allow me to go to the investment environment, because I was looking backward now, and I think it's good to look into the future and what are the relevant elements to be considered. And that's the slide we introduced in 2022 already. And it shows you nicely what we believe, that private debt is nicely positioned between fixed income and equities. So we have on the one hand side equity-like return, lower volatility, but shorter duration, so cash flows come back for private markets actually relatively quickly, which in my mind is a very good advantage, because in environments of uncertainty, money coming back gives you the opportunity to take a new decision, which I think is extremely important. I feel sometimes it's hard in this environment to predict what the next 30 years actually bring. So having shorter term private market allocation is extremely helpful. Now, looking at this market environment, I believe we still have, like in 22, still a lot of uncertainty post-pandemic and probably as well in the current political environment. And what we look at is obviously economical growth and inflation that was already discussed previously. And we believe that economical growth will be slightly lower than we probably have seen in the past. And inflation continues to persist to some extent. And especially there will be some fluctuations around inflation expectation. To what these factors actually lead is, on the one hand side, if you look at the equity side, it leads to challenges on valuation and accordingly to volatility. But as well on interest rates, as we have seen over the previous years, we've seen on the fixed income side volatility which equal to one that we have seen on equities. And so on fixed income and equity, there was a lot of volatility. Being in the middle provided more stability. And the scenery really changed in 2022 when rates started to raise. What happened really since then? I mentioned already at that part of time the balance between equity and debt slightly tipped in favor of debt. Why? Because the higher equity financing costs had to be absorbed by equities. And accordingly, the relative attractiveness became more appealing on the debt side than on the equity. Not saying that equity returns won't be higher, but ultimately on a risk-adjusted basis, debt is very attractive. And what we show here on this slide on the left is actually the performance since 22 up to the end of 24, where you see that direct lending did not just outperform public debt, but it outperformed as well public equity and private equity during this period. And maybe what has been even more relevant for many of the private market investors is that distribution of cash flows compared to any other private market strategies remained extremely stable over this period, meaning it allowed, and that's what Ariel will show in a minute when we talk about the current program, it really allowed the program to be self-funding over the period, which I think is very important. To close, and here just one comment, you know, again, in the longer horizon, I would call it again, since 2006 that I think we showed the chart here, you know, compared to many of the potential alternative public and private strategies that are available for investors, I think private debt has truly proven to be a steady ship in very choppy waters. You look at GFC, you look at the Eurozone crisis, you look at the first Trump 1.0 impact, you look at the rate rise in 2022. In all these very critical situations, it has been very steady. Again, looking forward, I think currently, obviously, in everybody's mind is a little bit the question, what do the current policies actually mean in terms of finance for the financial investments, especially for private debt? And a lot of people talk about the tariffs, but I believe we need to look at the broad range of policies and what the impact might be. And that means it's not just international trade with tariffs. It means we need to look, obviously, as well at fiscal policy, deregulation, and we need to look as well at immigration questions. And what we're looking at is always, what does this mean in terms of economical impact, GDP? Will we have a positive GDP increase or a decline potentially? How does this impact accordingly the earnings of the companies? What does it mean in terms of inflation as well? And then again, derived from that in terms of base rate. And you see here a bit, if you look at the overall policies, you have probably impacts on both sides, and it's hard to say at this stage in which direction ultimately the net impact of the policies might drive the economy. Obviously, when we look at tariffs isolated, you know, it looks as if it has a negative GDP impact, but maybe fiscal policy and deregulation compensate part of that ultimately. Very hard to assess ultimately, and because we don't have a crystal ball, and which what I will show you in a second is we work normally with scenarios, and we show you these scenarios in a second that help us better understand what the implications might be under what type of scenario. Now, scenarios are helpful then, first of all, to assess the impact on existing portfolios. We do this in a second, but before I look at the impact on an existing portfolio like yours, let us allow to have a look as well going forward. What does it mean for new allocations into private debt? And currently, due to the uncertainty, we see actually some positive impact on new allocations into private debt instruments. And the reason is, first of all, kind of the pricings that we see in this uncertain environment. So credit spreads increased slightly. So we see actually stronger pricing, more attractive returns. And we see as well that the credit metrics, the covenants got tighter again. That means we have more control over the borrowers, all elements that we actually like in new transactions. Obviously, what we need to watch out for is now fundamentals, number one. You know what happens to the economy, but we know which type of industries are impacted a bit more, and we can reflect that in our underwriting process. But obviously, with uncertainty, what happens as well, there will be less transaction volumes. The market gets a bit stale. And so one of the true challenge very often is in programs like the one that we have is reinvesting the positive cash flows that come back into these attractive type of transactions. But we have a solution for that. Now, I talked about it before talking about the scenarios and maybe as well taking a step back, we talk here about the middle market. And there is a difference between the middle market companies and obviously global companies. Obviously, global companies, they have much more trade dependencies, first of all. And so you can assume that the middle market's in tendency is slightly less impacted than many of the global-oriented company in a first step. Not to be underestimated, there will be second-order impacts. You know, if there is a slowdown, obviously, that will affect each and everybody. Now, as I mentioned, no crystal ball available. So what we do and what we did already during the pandemic, during the start of the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, we start creating scenarios. And the three scenarios this time that we have created are, we started in the middle with what we call the Liberation Day. The Liberation Day, just assuming that the tariffs will be applied the way they have been defined. I wouldn't say that is the most likely scenario, but it's definitely a scenario that we need to have on the table to see what the impact might be. To the left, you have then the so-called trade deal scenario. So the assumption is that the major trading blocks, for sure, probably your neighbor countries, probably the European Union, some of the major Asian strategic partners, probably there will be a type of trade deal. Maybe not all tariffs will disappear, but there will be some kind of trade deals. China might take more time, so that's the scenario on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, just to show an extreme, we have assumed trade war. So meaning, international trade more or less starts stopping. Retaliation measures will be taken by other trading blocks and obviously the consequences out of that. I give you a bit of feeling of the numbers and tell you then what that means. So in the Liberation Day scenario and pretty much in line with consensus of many of the macroeconomic studies, we have assumed that GDP in the US would decline between 100 and 150 basis points. So starting base is 200 basis points GDP growth expectation, actually, and so we deducted from that 100 to 150 basis points. So we're not in a full recession, actually, but we have a reduction of GDP, significant. In the trade deal scenario, we only reduced GDP by about 50 basis points in expectation. And if we then go to the trade war, we really go into recession, assuming there is no GDP growth, even maybe a minus 100 basis point GDP decline over a certain period of time. Normally, we assume here 12 months. What this data set now allows us to do is the following. We have on our platform that we manage about 1,500 private credits, where we get from all borrowers quarterly fundamental data. And what we do now is we can stress this data under the different scenarios per specific sector. So we have the historical kind of data available to see which sector is impacted by a GDP decline, how much. We stress the EBITDAs of the companies accordingly. And what that does ultimately is we create default scenarios. So how many companies will really go bankrupt and how much recovery will we have if they come out of a bankruptcy, as an example. So that's what we do now here in the background. So allow me to go to the results of the analysis just to give you a bit of a feeling, and allow me to start with the trade deal scenario. To run you through a bit more in detail. So the trade deal scenario I mentioned, GDP will decline by about 50 basis points according to our assumptions. So GDP in the US being between 1.5 and 2% over 12 months. Our default rates in companies would increase to about 3.5%, and the loss rates that will be realized about 1.6% on a well-diversified existing portfolio. That's about double of what we have seen historically in a portfolio. We normally assume about 80 basis points, so we double the loss rates. Now you see the gray bar, actually, the gross returns before fees of direct lending would still be positive. We're still at about 8.3%. So that is a scenario where we say returns remain very stable. But what is important as well is now to see what would the comparable markets actually do in this scenario. And so what we do in the colored points, you see they're green, red, and gray. This is, the green is actually the broadly syndicated loan market, which is public. This market we stress with the same assumptions because we have the data available. In a model, in a scenario like that, that market would be down by about 2%. We do the same for the high yield bond market, that would be down about 3.5%, and equity markets being down close to 6%. So that's the scenario trade deal. Now, what I think is very interesting, when we look now at the public market data, and that's a bit my interpretation of it, and we were looking here, took a snapshot of April 9, right after the announcement. In our mind, public markets were actually pricing in that there is a trade deal and a marginal impact on the asset classes, on GDP. So that means for me, if we now go to one of the other scenarios and the impact might be bigger, we see there is a lot of room for potential volatility. We've seen as well equity market recovered the losses already. So for them actually, there are no tariffs actually in our mind applied and no impact on GDP, which might be a certain likelihood. But what I would like to point out here, I do expect a lot of volatility depending on which trade deals might be announced, when they might be announced, and what happens all in between. There is a lot of room. Because you see the middle Liberation Day scenario, we would expect, you know, if GDP is reduced by 100 to 150 basis points, equity market and public debt market could be down significantly more. You would though still see that a direct lending portfolio like yours, well diversified, would remain in positive territories based on the loss assumptions and recoveries that we have taken. I currently do not comment the worst case scenario any further, but it's a GFC-like scenario that you see on the right-hand side, where you just see we would go in a more serious recession. Still, direct lending overall would withheld pretty well, in general, very resilient, but I believe, you know, public markets would suffer accordingly. I stop here before we go to the portfolio review, but you might have some questions, you know, to our assumptions and the market interpretation.
Any questions? Okay.
Great. Thanks, Marcel. So we'll go into the portfolio. Just as a reminder, you know, we started this partnership in 2017, so it's been almost 8 years. We're closing in on a decade. So we really have enjoyed the partnership with the team, as well as, you know, obviously the board, so appreciate that. The portfolio has grown, you know, considerably over that time period, not surprising. It's got about $1.5 billion in committed capital today. That's spread across, if you remember, core, which is really the SMAs, which is supposed to be the bulk of the program, satellites, which is more fund investments, and then co-investments. So core will always remain one of the biggest buckets. Satellites is where will be about 20-25%, and then the remainder, call it 5-ish percent, in co-investments and or secondaries. In terms of what we've done so far, since our last discussion, we added a $200 million upper middle market SMA in the core bucket. We also added a $30 million primary fund in that satellite bucket. And going forward, we do expect to add two more primary funds this year and obviously continue to recycle co-investments as they are repaid. The next page is just a nice breakdown of a reminder of how the program is structured. As Brian mentioned, it is a fund of one that we manage. So that SMA or core function is really direct lending based. That provides, as we just talked about, deployment, stability, diversification. It's primarily first lien. You're targeting returns of about 10%, so low double digits. The satellite is more of those primary funds. That's about 20% of your portfolio from a target perspective. This is where you can add some higher yielding investments, but it's really the point of this is to add some additional diversification away from direct lending to some of the more uncorrelated asset classes. And then lastly, we do have some co-investments in there that can provide deployment, diversification, as well as reduced costs, because they're obviously come at no fee, no carry, unlike a primary fund that has management fees and carry fees. I think this is a nice chart just to show the diversification on how the portfolio has been constructed. So if you think about just the core, you know, we have focused on the upper middle market, normal sponsor backed, as well as the new SMA we added is upper middle market, but adds that non-sponsored route. We also have middle market SMAs and lower middle market SMAs. And then on the satellite, as I said, this is more of the uncorrelated strategies to help diversify the portfolio further. So that includes some real estate debt funds, a few other DL diversifying funds, whether they're in non-correlated strategies or non-sponsored, as well as some regulatory capital, CLO equity, which we just added as well. So really providing a diverse range of opportunities for the portfolio to make a very diverse construction for your portfolio. And then as Marcel hit on, the beauty of direct lending is that deployment, especially if you're doing direct lending, can happen relatively quickly, but then cash also comes back quickly. And so that you'll see that basically as of 2023, you have this portfolio has been self-funding and will continue to be self-funding for the remainder of the forecast. And so that is what we want to see. We will hit your 13% target in about 2027. And so you'll see again the top chart, just the breakdown between co-investments, SMAs, primary funds, and co-investments in the blue, orange, and green, and how we hit to that 13%. What's important is that because this is a shorter duration asset class, you have that cash coming back so we can continue to make new decisions depending on how the market unfolds. I'll pause there before I go into performance if there are any questions. So my favorite slide probably that I show you guys every year because you know it shows just the stability of the portfolio. It is highly diversified. You have over 400 borrowers. As I said, you've committed $1.5 billion. But also if you look at just the stability of those bottom stats, you're about 4.5 times on average, you know, leverage level. So that is quite conservative. If you think about, you know, the overall Cliffwater Index or where other borrowers are, 4.5 times is very low. Most borrowers are now in the 5.5 to 6 times leverage range, especially those that are larger. This is a highly conservative portfolio. Your average EBITDA has stayed around that core middle market. As we said, that's a really resilient area in the U.S. It's not as exposed to potential tariffs and market uncertainty. And then, you know, as we pointed out, we find that the best risk-adjusted return historically has been in that first lien senior secured position, and so that's about 98% of your portfolio and has remained that way for the duration of the portfolio. So the next slide, another slide that I like to show, doesn't matter what time period you look at, this portfolio has outperformed, whether it's over the last 8 years or over the last 1 year or quarter to date. It's a very conservative portfolio. It's well deployed. It's diversified across direct lending. We've added, as I said, uncorrelated strategies that have led to a very nice return. And so it beats the Cliffwater Direct Lending Index as well as the S&P LSTA. And I think the next two slides, what's really important is the fact that this is a highly diverse portfolio, whether you go by strategy, by manager exposure. We have over 30 managers, which is really important. That's how you get to that 400 plus borrowers. And if you look just at the industry exposure on this page, you know, it is very, 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 very diversified across all industries. It's primarily right now 100% North America focused, which has benefited the portfolio historically. And we will look to see if there are other opportunities outside of the U.S. With the investment team as well. But I just wanted to highlight just the diversification across industry, borrower, manager, et cetera. And we find that to be very important. It's emblematic of how we run our portfolios on the private debt side. The diversification piece is very important from a downside protection standpoint. And then lastly, you know, we talk about cash flow. As I said, the business is self-funding. You did deploy about $226 million over the last LTM period. It will continue to be self-funding for the remainder of the forecast, as I said, including this year. And then lastly, you can just see how the deployment has panned out and just that we've stuck with obviously the core primary, core satellite and co-investment piece. And that core piece obviously will remain a pretty good cornerstone of the portfolio. So I'll pause there and see if there are any questions on the portfolio.
Any questions? John?
I'll say one does jump out to me on 100% North America. I assume North America includes Canada and Mexico.
It's really primarily U.S. It's a good question. There are very few investments you guys that have in Canada. There's only one manager on the SMA side that has done really anything in Canada, and it's one or two investments, so pretty minimal, and nothing that I know of in Mexico. So really primarily U.S.
Thank you.
Is there any thought given to what effect it might have with immigration and the change in agriculture and the effect that it's going to have on all the various corporations? Does agriculture step into this picture at all?
I would say, you know, we definitely have looked at general, you know, the fact of immigration policies, as I mentioned at the beginning. If immigration policy really becomes significantly more restrictive, it is clear it will exhibit inflationary pressure. And that's the way that we actually considered it ultimately in our model, you know, into these scenarios, kind of, that we do expect, and that's why we mentioned that remains favorable. Inflation will continue to persist for a longer period of time. Rates might not come down as fast as probably still expected in 2024. And that means, again, you know, all the consequences comparing them. What does it mean for the corporates, the financing costs? What does it mean for equity returns on the other side? Because, you know, I mean, we're on top of the capital structure, but somebody has to pay it. And so I would say we haven't looked now specifically at the agriculture industry isolated, but obviously we looked at immigration policies and the implications of inflation and then the base rate.
Mike, just to follow up on that, the agriculture industry is really, really interesting in that it doesn't look like the broader private market set of size range that we have in the United States. So, we, you know, Marcel was talking about the middle market companies, aren't the global companies, these aren't mom and pop shops. Agriculture kind of misses that middle piece. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of owner operators, independent farmers, land managers, that sort of thing, on a smaller end of the scale. And then you've got the global commodity trading houses and equipment manufacturers, and that middle is just kind of missing. Mm-hmm. And the team has spent a lot of time, you know, trying to approach this to say, hey, we don't have a lot of agriculture and land exposure. Is there something here? And that missing middle, it's a really challenge. So that's part of the story.
As a second partnership here, noting how much time and effort it takes to build a foundational piece of a program like this. And it's been a pretty eventful morning, honestly, with the experience study from an actuarial perspective, looking at how consistent the board has been in setting funding policy over a long time horizon. And that same commitment is required, I think, in building a private markets program. And I think it's hard to let this moment go by without saying, it's been a lot of effort, and congratulations, really, on getting to the point where you have a self-funded program, something that's pretty consistent over time. Through different staff turnover, maybe through different, definitely through different economic cycle, different crises, I think it's great. Great work.
Appreciate that. I mean, I think when the board made the decision to go down this pathway back in 2017, it was somewhat of an abstract concept. It was, you know, hey, the banks are paying back from lending, and you know, you can go in with general partners and be that whole loan originator into the marketplace here. Great idea. What's it going to look like? How do you get it up and running? So there was a lot of foundational work to say, what are the parameters? We're going to do this on a fund-by-fund basis. We're going to go directly to general partners instead of the SMAs. Ultimately, we decided to work with Stepstone on an implemented solution. I think that's been great. But you know, we are talking about over $1 billion of current assets. It's got a 10% crit target. It's got a 13% long-term target. This is a big chunk. This is 1/7 of the overall growth portfolio. And I think the fact that we still are experiencing these low double-digit returns with, to date, limited downside. I appreciate Marcel's scenario analysis, but yeah, I think this is a newer asset class. It's got a lot of great attributes. And that, you know, when banks get in trouble, it's because they're borrowing short and lending long as a leveraged balance sheet. While as an asset owner, we don't have that borrowing short element, so we're a more natural long-term lender there. It all looks great on paper, but this was a new asset class when we started this. And we were on the newer side of it, but we definitely had a positive experience. We keep waiting for a shakeout, a strong test. We've had small tests, but it has been a very impactful portion of the growth portfolio. And now that it's self-funding, you know, it frees up liquidity elsewhere in the portfolio. So I think that is, I appreciate you noticing that, and I think that is important. After this, is more of a standalone portfolio that you can rely on for cash flow in the future.
Excuse me, I turned my own hearing aid sound. So one of the concerns that came up with private equity in the recent past was that everyone was chasing private equity because of the yield when fixed income was low. And so that seemed to stress the private equity arena. And how many deals can you do, right? And that, and how, what's the quality of them? So that's something we all have to be mindful of. But with private credit, from what I understand, that's a different story in that the demand is massive compared to what has been deployed at this time. And I think we don't have to worry about a so-called flood of folks chasing private credit, but a big question, which I think we utilize StepStone for, is with the expansion of the private credit world, assuring that you have quality managers to handle those funds. And I know that's something you look out for and screen, and because everyone's opening up offices and so forth. And so how do you deal with that?
You're absolutely right. You know, obviously any growth area in any industry will attract new participants on an ongoing basis. And I think that is always one of the risks. As I mentioned, we are a team that is over 25 years in the market, and how we have handled across the different market cycles. I mean, we actually started during the Asian crisis LTCM. So we went through .com, WorldCom, Enron, and all the following. And one element that we noted is a certain discipline and hardcore guidelines and criteria is extremely helpful, even if a market changes. And we have defined that going beyond the manager selection in the sense of normally we set very clear guidelines, and that's why we operate as well a bit differently. We're not allocating just to funds in the market, but we set up SMAs with the GPs accordingly, where these investment guidelines can be implemented that protect us potentially to A, participate in any type of cycle. You know, you've seen always exaggeration, you know, go back post-pandemic 21 as an example. A lot of transaction took place, and probably if we compare this to many other funds in the market, our separate managed accounts probably would exclude about 40% of the deal flow in these type of markets. And this discipline, I think, helps on top to just selecting good GPs that need to understand the market, that need to originate good transaction, that need to be able as well to work out critical situation, which is very important. But some additional overlay of A, discipline and guidelines, B, creating additional diversification, as we mentioned, which is a key concept in the overall portfolio construction, just helps to minimize the impact of any surprises, which, as we all know, they will always come, you know, to a certain extent. But that's what we try to achieve here.
But, I mean, David, to your point, when we started this conversation 8 years ago, there was already concern about the growth of private credit mm-hmm. and how big can this get, and that's part of why we set up the separate accounts, is because we wanted to write the investment guidelines. And I remember very early morning conversations between, well, early morning for me, late evening for Marcel, about what was going to be the parameters here. And we said, well, you know, we've got to have covenants in the loans. You know, the strength of the covenants is going to vary over time, but, you know, we can't have anything that is covenant light or covenant free. We've got to have recourse. We've got to be able to work out these assets. And Marcel's point to me over and over again was, you can't possibly over diversify in this space. You need to have a lot of line items in here. And so I think we've been able to navigate the growth of the industry. We've been able to keep the strength of the underwriting of what goes into the portfolio strong. Stepstone's got a good, robust conversation going with all the underlying managers and shadow accounting and all the underlying line items. So it is it's a lot of work to navigate this. You are right that the industry has gotten heavily supplied with capital, but there's a tremendous demand on the other side. And then, I think looking forward, we're now talking about the expansion of the definition of private credit from primarily direct lending to what's now known as asset-based lending. Most lending is asset-based lending, but that's a new term out there. But you know, there is the disintermediation of banks is a long-term trend. I know the current Treasury Secretary would like to walk some of that back in the United States, but that's where we stand now. Banks don't lend as much. Banks are not the natural lenders of some of these long-term, longer-term loans, and we just kind of sit as asset owners in a better position to be the originators. It has expanded tremendously, but so far, the uptake has been good.
And maybe to add here, it was not just disintermediating the banks. It obviously takes share as well of the public markets, because public markets and public financing are not always as flexible. You know, in an environment that is fast changing and very dynamic, it's sometimes very hard to issue a bond, as an example. So you see as well, you know, the private debt borrowers actually grew over time. Normally they might have gone to public markets, harder to finance there. So you see the market growth as well, underlying of borrowers that need to be served through private debt has increased.
Just on that, I mean, public markets are not always open. So as sponsors and borrowers look for reliable partners, private credit has grown because they are a reliable partner. Not only can they customize solutions, but they are there when the public markets are not there. And that's really important when you think about the middle market and those companies. They need the ability, sponsors need the ability to buy businesses. Businesses need the ability to then do add-ons, incrementals, et cetera, when they're growing to continue to create value to employees, shareholders, et cetera. And public markets and banks are just not always reliable partners at the end of the day.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Jerry?
Slide 35, if you could, Beck. I'm struck by the...
Okay, I got to see which one it is.
The 35?
Yeah, no, sorry. I can't see the bottom there, so I'm just looking to see so I know which one it is. Okay. Exposure industries, yeah.
Got it. I'm struck by the pie chart on the left, the one on the right too, but the one on the left in particular seems to be almost an afterthought on energy. And yet all the stuff that I read suggests that energy is just an unbelievable opportunity, and it's getting, if nothing, it's getting larger.
And the consumption of energy worldwide is just unfathomable, just to see the amount that's being consumed. And it doesn't look like windmills and solar cells are going to do it. So, I mean, I see a lot of discussion about nuclear coming back and smaller nuclear generating plants, and also coal, the hated coal, the hated, you know, carbon fuels and whatnot. But the idea is that the energy has to come from somewhere. And the other part of that graph that shows the information technology area, not growing necessarily, but this doesn't show growth, but that's clearly there. They're a massive consumer of energy. So is there some reason that the dedication of them is so small to energy at this point? Or is that something that we're looking at more?
It goes a bit probably back similar to what Tim mentioned before in the agricultural space. There are hardly any mid-sized energy companies. You know, in the middle market, truly, you won't find that. So the question is, you need to go to the large corporates, actually, in the energy space, or probably, if you think about the private market strategy, you're more leaning towards infrastructure type of investment, like infrastructure core equity, for example, that probably covers that space better. You know, so there are no middle-sized energy companies really, or a lot of them that need financing, and so they will not be in that space. You have then the large multinational energy conglomerates that you are well aware of, you know, from the Aramcos to the Exxons to Shell, you know, the very large ones. And then you have the obviously infrastructure projects probably which cover very well, you know, a lot of this. And obviously that doesn't go into the defined, you know, corporate lending space of these middle-sized companies.
To that point, and not focusing so much on the end user, the people downstream, the companies downstream that are providing the infrastructure, that are providing turbines, that are providing all the rest of the stuff that the big guys are using, those strike me as more of a middle-sized opportunity.
And those tend to fall actually into the industrial sector, so that's where you'll find them. Yeah. So we actually do review a fair amount of those, because you're right, those that not only manufacture the turbines, but create the parts, maintain them, all of that, that's all in the industrial sector.
Correct.
And the infrastructure, again, to hit on that, it's just, the stuff I read suggests the infrastructure in this country is 60s, if we're lucky, maybe 70s. So the idea of being able to raise that infrastructure and make it less fragile than it is now, it seems just extraordinary an opportunity. And in terms of North America, I guess I'm hoping that as you look at stuff in the Southeast area, Southeast Asia area, that you stop at the Chinese line, and focus your attention on the Vietnams, the Cambodias, the Australias, the Philippines and whatnot, which look to me as if they're great potential for manufacturing sites. And China looks to me like it's on the edge. I'm a big China fan, as Tim knows. But it looks like a real good opportunity to pass up these days.
Well, when you're a lender, rule of law is pretty critical. So the fact that we don't even really have material exposure to Europe yet probably tells you the conservatism built into the portfolio.
Well, energy for Europe too, same thing. Yeah. You got a lot of people that are at the mercy of certain suppliers of energy in Europe. It's just, it's massive.
We've just seen last week now in Spain and Portugal, you know, the big blackout.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that the team is based historically in Switzerland and we have all North America tells you where the opportunity set is. So.
But it's not the only part of the world that needs energy, so that's, okay.
Okay, great. I don't see any other questions. Thank you both very, very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.